competing visions for the Democratic Party and the country were on display this week in Detroit. We're talking about the Democratic presidential debates here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The second round of debates highlighted divisions between progressives and more centrist Democrats and also brought a lot more heated exchanges. Going back to Tuesday night, we saw Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren surrounded by skeptics of programs like Medicare for All and the Green New Deal. Former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper called the initiatives a, quote, disaster at the ballot box, while Maryland Representative John Delaney shot down the senators for offering, quote, impossible promises. But Warren, she struck back.
You know, I don't understand why anybody goes to all the trouble of running for president of the United States just to talk about what we really can't do and shouldn't fight for.
So let's get analysis now with your thoughts and questions along the way. Did you watch either of the debates this week? What are your takeaways? Join in at 800-642-1234. Wendy Scattergood is a political science professor at St. Norbert College in De Pere. Wendy, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you joined us in June to discuss that first round of Democratic debates, which were in Miami. Did you see any candidates perform better this week than in their first round?
Well, I think we saw on night one a lot more from Delaney. I think he really picked up the game and we heard a lot more from him. And certainly Bullock, we didn't see him in round one. So I think a lot of people were interested to see where he was going to come from. I think on night two, we saw a lot more from Andrew Yang, for example, didn't have a lot of minutes compared to everybody else. But I think we saw some more of his message coming through that we didn't see as much on night one.
Tulsi Gabbard, as well, I understand, had a pretty high surge in Google searches after her performance.
Yeah, she really went after Kamala, particularly on her issues when she was the Attorney General of California. And I think she really stuck it to her. And I think a lot of people were thinking that people weren't going to go up against Kamala. She's a prosecutor. You know, that's a tough thing. And I think she really made a very strong assertion about her arguments. And so that's where she came out. And then also at the end, you know, particularly in her closing statements and some of her talk about, you know, being a veteran and getting out of Afghanistan. And I think those are sort of very powerful emotional appeals that she was able to make.
Well, healthcare really seemed to get a lot of attention at both debates. What other issues really stood out to you?
Well, I think looking at, particularly on last night, I think looking at attacking Joe Biden a lot more than they did. I mean, they did it in the first debate, but we saw that a lot more of that, particularly coming from Kamala and from Cory Booker, which we've seen in the past couple of weeks, them going after it. I think we saw that sort of writ large. Immigration issues, I think, you know, sort of came to the fore, making the case again on both nights about whether it should be decriminalized. And I think, particularly on night one, I think they didn't make the case about what does it really mean to decriminalize and versus making it a civil violation. I think that was a little bit clearer on night two than it was on night one. Conversely, though, I think on night one, we saw a much clearer divide between sort of the progressives and the more moderate candidates. And I think that was a little bit more muddy on night two.
Talking with Wendy Scattergood, she's a political scientist from St. Norbert College, looking at this week's presidential debates. With your thoughts, did you watch the first debate on Tuesday or the second one last night? What are your reactions? What do you think of the candidates' responses on issues that you care about? Join in 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Wendy, these debates followed President Trump insulting the city of Baltimore and critics who are people of color. And these attacks were really widely condemned by Democrats as racist. How did the candidates talk about race during the debates?
Well, I think obviously on night two is where we had the candidates of color were on the stage versus night one, which was, you know, all the white candidates. And so night two, I think it was certainly made a lot more present, talking about those issues. And that's really kind of where they were going after Joe Biden, although I think he had a strong statement of kind of that one moment, if you will, of unity, where he was saying, you know, look at everybody up on this stage. And this is kind of, this diversity is what makes Americans stronger rather than weaker. Cory Booker had the unbleeped out comment about the countries of saying that they were, you know, that's again what makes us stronger. And so I think they definitely, especially on night two, made a lot more comments about it. Even Kirsten Gillibrand talking about why she can talk about what white privilege actually means and bring that out and kind of convert people to understanding that issue.
Well, you mentioned there Senator Cory Booker, and criminal justice got a lot of attention in last night's debate with Hawaii Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard going after Kamala Harris's record as a prosecutor, as you said. Biden and Booker also criticized each other's record on criminal justice. And here is Cory Booker.
Oh, and people right now in prison for life for drug offenses because you stood up and used that tough on crime phony rhetoric that got a lot of people elected but destroyed communities like mine.
So what did you take away from the candidates talking about criminal justice?
One of the things is an interesting issue is that we're talking about some of the bills that were passed and supported by Joe Biden are, you know, a couple of decades old at this point. And so the question is how people are going to react to that if they get kind of stuck in that past. On the one hand, I don't think that's going to be very favorable to them because people are going to want to be thinking about how to go forward. On the other hand, you know, it is important for candidates to differentiate themselves and to talk about their past records. I mean, that's how we try to judge what kinds of decisions they're going to make as they go forward. I'm not sure that Joe Biden did a lot to kind of talk about the evolution of his thinking. It's all when I talk to my students about, well, you know, sometimes they go look back and they look at their college papers and they use that as their records and they all get kind of terrified because they know what they do when they write their current papers. You know, and I'm always thinking, well, gosh, you know, I learn new things every single day. And if my thought didn't evolve over time, that would be kind of terrifying. So I think it's a very difficult line for all of the candidates, but particularly someone like Joe Biden, who's been around for so long, to kind of talk about the evolution of his thinking and how it should change. You know, that would be weird if he didn't change his viewpoints, but I'm not sure he really made that case. But then, you know, there's always the flip side of that, of thinking of people are going to accuse you of being a flip-flopper or, you know, sort of justifying it after the fact. And I think, you know, we saw that also with Kirsten Gillibrand kind of went after him on women's rights and talking about how the child care tax that he was saying that was, you know, would take down the American family and stuff like that. And he was kind of talking about, well, you know, his first wife and, you know, certainly Jill have worked all the way through. And he just didn't have a really good comeback for that. And so I think, you know, we didn't see him have a particularly strong debate because of that.
Well, let's pause right there with St. Norbert College political science professor Wendy Scattergood, who is with us for analysis. Second set, presidential primary debate started in Detroit Tuesday. Last night, Democrats took the stage again. Getting your reaction, 800-642-1234. What issues do you think the Democratic presidential candidates should be talking about? Do you plan to watch future debates going forward? What will you be looking for? Call in, email ideas, WPR.org. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. CNN hosted the second set of Democratic presidential debates this week in Detroit. We're looking back at those debates, also looking ahead at what these 20 Democratic presidential hopefuls may do next. The third televised debate of the party primary set for September in Houston will likely be more condensed version of the sprawling Democratic field we see right now. What themes did you see in this week's debates? What did they tell us about the Democratic Party? Who do you think were this week's debate winners and losers? Join in 800-642-1234. St. Norbert College political scientist Wendy Scattergood stays with us for analysis. Let's go to Erica now, joining us from Madison. Hi, Erica.
Hello.
So what was on your mind about the debates you saw?
Well, I'd like to comment on the debates in general, and I'd like to hear your guest talk about the influence that social commentators are having on our elections. And by that I mean that, you know, it's the most dramatic thing to call on and to have on your guest show people who are the most contentious, who interrupt the most, who have the biggest splash, and they're also setting guidelines based on raising money percentages more than a year in advance of the actual election. So from my perspective, I think that CNN and MSNBC are having a influence on who the Democratic Party selects, and I'd like to have your guest talk a little bit about how that has changed from when the League of Women Voters started the debates in the 1970s near the election and with much more questions that delved much more into the politics, and not about the attitude. We are discussing the attitude of these candidates, and their attitude is determining whether or not they're going to be our candidate.
Erica, thanks so much. Wendy, what do you make of the debates, the moderators, and the media?
Yeah, I think there's a lot to that, and I think that's a really good comment. So one of the things, first of all, just talking about the timing, we are so far out. I think part of that is we have a lot of candidates, and there's got to be this winnowing process. So to some extent, because there are so many of them, and we need to hear from them over a longer time period, that kind of shows you that, you know, that's a kind of a good idea in the sense of that. Looking at the moderators from CNN and MSNBC, there has been a lot of criticism in other media sources talking about the kinds of questions that they asked and even the way that they ask them to kind of talk about different policy issues. We saw that a lot last night in saying, you know, this person disagrees with you, how do you respond to that? And so you're sort of setting them up to say, you know, to give a political answer rather than a policy answer to some extent, to have it be more of sort of an attack rather than a debate of saying, okay, these are the different stances, this is how they differ, this is what it would do. So I do think that, and there's been a lot of like criticism, particularly against CNN, of talking about it sort of being reality TV-like and a lot of drama.
Candidates speaking very quickly, covering so much ground.
Yeah, and interrupting each other, like you said. And I know that, you know, one of the things that people talk about when they're, what's the most important issue? And people, there are a lot of policy issues that people are interested in. But then there's also a lot of people are saying, you know, the most important problems facing the country are these things like poor leadership or ethical and moral decline and lack of respect for each other. And I know that we've seen that in our data as well for quite a long time. And so it's important that we do hear people's difference on policy issues, but, you know, at the same time, I don't think it's a bad thing for the American people to be trying to judge people's character, because ultimately when they get into office, they are going to have to make decisions on new things. And I think the American people have to trust someone to kind of use good judgment. And so it does allow us to kind of see some of that, and it's not necessarily a bad thing for people to be judging their presidential candidates on both policy and their assessment of the person's character and their ability to make decisions.
Well, let's bring in Keith now in Beaver Dam with thoughts. Keith, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Last night, the subject came up about decriminalizing drug crimes, and Joe Biden had a very tough, strong record on crime. And I was kind of disappointed that he ran away from his record, and that back in the 90s when they had the tough crime bill come out, Bill Clinton was president. He had to defend that in the last election with Hillary, and I thought Joe should have defended his record. These drug dealers were selling drugs to our kids in school, and they had to come up with some laws that if you got caught within so many feet of a school, you know, you couldn't sell, you know, I mean, they were coming down heavy. These weren't just people, maybe some of them are personally using drugs. They were selling drugs, and they were, you know, and I think he missed out on a great opportunity to defend his record. Keith, and why they did it.
Yeah, Keith, thank you for those comments. Wendy, what about in that area and how he could have defended his record?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And one of the things that they need to distinguish and needs to be clear is the difference between sort of being tough on crime versus kind of treating different people differently under the law. So, I mean, one of the issues about the crime bills is the difference in sentencing between selling crack versus selling cocaine, which affects different people in different ways. And so I think that's kind of what, like, Kamala and Cory Booker are trying to get at, and I'm not sure that was that clear, because, you know, the American people want, for example, strong border security. They want sort of people to be tough on crime, but at the same time, you know, to be treated equally under the law. And I think that needs to be clear, and I think Joe Biden, but also the other candidates, needed to be clear about how to be tough on crime, but also fair at the same time.
Talking with Wendy Scattergood, a political scientist from St. Norbert College, about this week's presidential debate. Still time with your thoughts to come forward. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. You know, which candidates do you think, Wendy, walked away from the debates this week with more momentum, with more ability to propel their campaigns forward?
I do think that Delaney, for example, I think he came out of night one. I think people saw him more than they did in the first debate. I think he went after Elizabeth Warren and Bernie a lot more. I think it was a little bit more muddy on night two. I think Kamala Harris got attacked a lot more. She got in the first debate. She's the one that kind of went from that third tier of people who were polling kind of in the single digits into the second tier, which is where Elizabeth Warren and Bernie are. She was able to take that bump from the first debate and kind of move into that second tier. The question is, will we see any of the candidates like Pete Buttigieg, for example? Will he's been polling a little bit better, but he hasn't kind of broken into that double digits. And it'll be interesting to see whether he does. I think Jay Inslee kind of made a lot more inroads. He got a lot more time than he did in the first debate, so people got to look at him a little bit more. I'm not sure that any of those folks are going to break into that. And certainly as we go into the September debate, it gets a little bit harder. They've got to be polling at 2% rather than 1%, and they've got to have more donors from more states.
And CNN, they called this debate Beto O'Rourke's chance to revive his campaign amid this slump in the polls and fundraising. What did we see from the representative from Texas?
A lot of his responses were pretty wooden and very rehearsed. I think he looked kind of nervous. I think we didn't see his kind of folksy, can relate to the average person kind of thing that we saw during his Senate campaign that kind of made him very popular. We didn't see any of that kind of personality come through. And so I don't think he's going to be helped by that. He didn't make any mistakes. Certainly there's nothing that could immediately tank him, but I don't think he's going to take momentum coming out of this second debate.
Well, help us understand the winnowing that goes on next. The debates this week could be really critical because the next debate, it'll be a smaller number of people on stage. And how does that happen? What happens in fundraising and the criteria to qualify?
Yeah. So as we said, you've got to be polling. So in about a month, the Democratic Party is going to look at the major polls and see, you know, are you polling at about the 2% as opposed to the 1% that was for these last two debates. You also have to have a lot more donors. From 65,000 to 130,000 donors. So, and it's an and or. So you could have a lot of donors, for example, but still not be polling well and do that. So I think that's, we expect that we're going to see people kind of drop out. I mean, the one thing about Pete, Mayor Pete, is that in the second quarter fundraising, these last couple of months, he actually came in at number one of all the Democratic candidates at $25 million, with Biden in second place at $22 million.
So still a lot to watch there. Wendy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Wendy Scattergood is a professor of political science at St. Norbert College in De Pere. Coming up, some rural hospitals in Wisconsin are shutting down their obstetrical units. We'll find out why after this news update here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about maternal care in rural Wisconsin. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Last year, a hospital in Grantsburg, population 1,300, stopped delivering babies. Burnett Medical Center CEO Gordy Lewis told WPR that with only 40 births a year, they couldn't justify the cost. So they partnered with a Minnesota hospital across the border.
It's a tough decision to give up those services to any community, but particularly a rural community. We had to look at the facts, and I think we've come up with a workable and satisfactory and creative solution.
So Grantsburg isn't alone. A new report says nearly a dozen rural Wisconsin hospitals have stopped delivering babies over the past decade. Are you pregnant and living in a rural area? How far do you travel for prenatal care? What do you think about some rural hospitals no longer offering maternal care? And what distance will you drive to deliver your baby? 800-642-1234 to join in. Dr. Ellen Hartenbach is vice chair of the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of Wisconsin Medical School. She's also a professor in the Division of Gynecologic Oncology at UW-Madison. Dr. Hartenbach, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate.
Well, help us understand these challenges. Why are rural hospitals closing their maternal units?
Well, the report that the Wisconsin Office of Rural Health put out really helps us understand what's going on in Wisconsin and the nation. So what they're telling us is that there are less births, and so some of the counties don't need as many facilities. But more importantly, they're telling us they're having trouble with getting the workforce, that is the skilled physicians, nurses, midwives, people that are important to provide those services. And finally, the economics are a problem.
What about the economics? Why is it so costly to run these departments?
Well, childbirth is the most common reason for hospitalization in the United States. And yet, the funding can be tricky. About half of the births in the U.S. and similarly in Wisconsin are funded by Medicaid. And the Medicaid payers, it's not quite as lucrative as some other healthcare services. So there are some funding issues. And Wisconsin did not expand Medicaid coverage, so that's an issue for us.
Dr. Hartenbach, some hospitals, though, that deliver lots of babies, those birthing units should be a pretty robust revenue stream for those hospitals because these are mothers going in for, 48 hours and not sucking up a lot of resources, I mean, not staying at the hospital very long. You would think that that would be a pretty profitable revenue stream.
You do. You'd think that maternity care services would be helpful for the hospitals, but I'm not a specialist in hospital economics, but I do know that that maternity care is not as well reimbursed as some other care in hospitals. Neonatal intensive care units tend to be generators, revenue generators for hospitals. So the economics is one piece. The other thing is, you have to have 24/7 services, and you need to be able to provide safe maternity care for vaginal births, and you also need to be able to provide cesarean section 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And that's also not easy for hospitals that are delivering fewer than 100 babies a year in particular.
So birth rates, let's look at those. They've declined over the past 10 years in Wisconsin. There were more than 72,000 births in 2007. 2017, there were less than 65,000 births. Why are we seeing birth rates go down?
I think that's a great question. They have been declining in the United States for the past 40 years. As you said, there was a little peak in 2007 before the last recession, and then they've been declining over the past decade. I think couples are choosing to have fewer babies, and I am not 100% clear on why birth rates are down in the United States, but right now we rank number around 72 in the world. There are a number of countries that have lower birth rates than the United States, but ours is lower than a lot of other nations.
We're looking at rural maternal care with Dr. Ellen Hartenbach. She's vice chair of the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of Wisconsin Medical School. You can join in with your observations, 800-642-1234. Do you work at a rural hospital? Are you seeing a worker shortage? Is your maternity department open or has it closed recently? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Chris now in Waukesha. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. Great show as usual. Yeah, I just want to say that the guest kind of underrepresents the reimbursement rate problem. It is the primary problem in all of healthcare that the, you know, whenever government gets involved with it, things get too complicated and money goes to compliance rather than patient care. And if you just can't provide quality care at reimbursement rate. That's just a simple fact.
And Chris, I understand that you're a nurse. What do you see in staffing?
I do see, you know, Wisconsin is blessed with a good culture of staffing. But yeah, when you have six or eight patients, you know, you can't get to all their needs all at the same time. I'm blessed to work at a facility that keep staffing at 4 to 5 patients per nurse. But, you know, I have worked in the higher acuity, higher patient population, and it's just not possible to provide great care. Look at your nursing homes. That's the primary problem with them is it's all Medicaid or Medicaid, and you can't keep a facility open at reimbursement rate.
Chris, thanks for those observations. Dr. Hartenbach, what do you see there in terms of staffing and in terms of reimbursement rates?
Well, I think the caller is correct that the reimbursement is a big issue. It's interesting. It wasn't commented on in the report, and I'm not quite sure why it wasn't as prominent by the people filling out the survey. The whole point of the Wisconsin Office of Rural Health survey was to find out what's going on right now in rural facilities. Who's delivering the babies? Are they closing? Are they thinking about closing? What are they struggling with? And the workforce is a huge issue. The Wisconsin Hospital Association put out a report. We are going to be short physicians. We have trouble keeping physicians in rural communities. We have trouble attracting them to rural communities. 20% of the population lives in rural areas, whereas only 10% of the population of physicians live in rural areas. But it's not just the physicians, it's the nurses and the other skilled workers at the hospital.
So what happens when a woman in labor shows up at a rural hospital ER that no longer offers maternal care?
That's a great question. And it's one of the issues that's a problem nationally, because this closure problem that we're having with rural facilities is happening across the country. So the American College of OBGYN has put out recommendations for what are called level of maternal care, which basically says if you're a level one facility giving basic maternity care in wherever you are, in an urban or suburban or rural area, you need to be hooked in with centers that have higher levels of care, specialty care, and the level four regional perinatal centers. So if a woman comes into an emergency room and they need obstetrical services, they're going to need to get in an ambulance and go to the nearest hospital facility that has those services.
And so would the patient then be responsible for paying to be transported to another hospital?
That's a fabulous question that I wish I knew the answer. As physicians, we are often asked many questions about payment, and it is so complicated in this day and age that we make no promises to our patients. I would think that that person ought to get reimbursed by their payer. But we would have to get people involved who understand healthcare financing.
Dr. Hartenbach, this makes me think that there would be more scheduled deliveries, that a woman living in a rural area driving an hour and a half on week 39 of that pregnancy, showing up for last week, and the physician, the OB saying, you know what? Couple days, just meet me at the hospital. We'll get that Pitocin going. We'll get this baby out. Do you think that there is a tendency then that we'll see more scheduled pregnancies as more rural hospitals close their maternal units?
Well, fortunately, in Wisconsin, we have very few people that need to go more than 30 miles. There are some areas up north where it's more than 30 minutes to get to that delivery hospital. There are places in the country where this is routine, not so much scheduling delivery, but having people stay closer. So if you live in Alaska, you get close to term pregnancy, you go and live near Juneau or Anchorage. You actually need to move closer to the facility. Now, getting into delivering early or delivering on demand or induction, that's a whole nother kettle of fish, and not always healthy for pregnancies to just make decisions to deliver. There's a lot of science that goes into that, and we need to be following the quality care recommendations in terms of elective delivery.
We're talking about rural maternal care as some Wisconsin hospitals close their obstetrical services and what that means. Dr. Ellen Hartenbach is vice chair of the Obstetrics and Gynecology Department at the University of Wisconsin Medical School. Are you a mother whose baby was delivered at a small town hospital? What was your experience like? How long ago was your child born? Do you work at a rural hospital? Is your obstetrical unit open? Join in 800-642-1234. Back for more in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about maternal care in rural Wisconsin. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The lack of OB care in rural areas is a challenge straight across the country. According to the American College of Nurse Midwives, nearly half of the counties in the U.S. don't have an OBGYN. 20 counties in Wisconsin are in that situation. And the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, they estimate there will be a shortage of OBGYNs that number in the thousands by next year. Still time for you, 800-642-1234. Are you pregnant and living in a rural area? How far do you travel for prenatal care? What are your thoughts about rural hospitals and obstetrical services? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. And Dr. Ellen Hartenbach stays with us. She's vice chair of the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the UW Medical School. Let's go to the phones now. Bill joining us in Barnes. Hi, Bill. Hi, Bill. Are you there?
Good morning.
Yeah, good morning.
Yeah, blanked out for a second. Good morning. First of all, I divide my time between Barnes and Bayfield County and Spooner and Washburn County. I know Washburn does not have an obstetrics unit. And I don't think Bayfield does either. I think those are among the rural counties that have lost obstetrics care. And reference has been made to government reimbursement rates and that the government is the problem. I don't know that that's exactly true. It's the rates themselves. They're not uniform around the country. Different areas get different reimbursement rates. Urban centers and southern urban centers especially get much higher reimbursement rates than a rural hospital does. And the other thing I guess I'd say that if you eliminated government reimbursements, eliminated Medicare, rural hospitals wouldn't just close their obstetrics units, they'd close entirely. The poverty rates in Washburn County, most people can't afford to have a baby delivered.
Bill, thank you for that. Dr. Hartenbach, there, you know, babies are expensive in delivering, and, you know, certainly the Affordable Care Act allowed, you know, some mothers to be able to have babies because it's expensive.
Yeah, it's true. No question, healthcare costs are out of control, and we need to help people in the rural communities.
Dr. Hartenbach, I know we talked back in 2016 about the role of rural residencies and getting more physicians interested in practicing OB services in rural areas. How has that rural residency program been going?
Oh, it's been thriving. We did start it in 2015 is when we began, and now we have 100 applicants for the one rural residency training track that we offer in the department. We're the first OBGYN department in the country to carve out a rural training track. It's something more common in family medicine, and family medicine provides a lot of rural care, but less rural maternity care as time goes on. There are less family physicians providing OB services. So we felt like we need to make sure that we are training OB physicians who feel comfortable delivering patients in hospitals that have lower volumes. So the majority of the hospitals in our state deliver fewer than 500 babies a year, and the rural hospitals are often delivering, you know, 100, 200, or 300 babies a year. So it's a different environment. Our training hospitals tend to be in the urban areas where we have 2, 3, 4,000 babies a year. So it's important for our trainees to get this experience. And the rural training track in our department is very popular and is a model for other programs across the country.
How do those residents feel about being the only OB physician for miles and miles around? Because that could be perhaps somewhat isolating, a burden, and a little bit scary. You don't have colleagues around you.
Well, that's the key to training. I'm the former residency program director also, and we have to have physicians in these hospitals to train our residents. So we don't put the residents in the hospital without a supervising obstetrician and gynecologist who's very skillful with providing maternity care in a rural setting. We've selected physicians who are the key OBGYN physician working with family physicians and nurse midwives and handling the entire center so that they can tutor our trainees to do the same in a small community when they graduate.
We're talking with Dr. Ellen Hartenbach. She's vice chair of the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of Wisconsin Medical School. We're looking at rural health care and specifically obstetrical services in rural settings. You can join in 800-642-1234. Dr. Hartenbach, the recent report from the Wisconsin Office of Rural Health also shows Wisconsin delivers more babies at rural hospitals than rural hospitals across the country. What are some reasons for that?
Well, I think that when it comes right down to it, Wisconsin is a rural state that has urban areas throughout the state. And so it's not quite as remote as some of the states out west in terms of getting services to rural populations. We also have a very strong history of our family physicians positioned across the state. We have excellent health care. And so I do think that we do better than many of the rural states in the nation. It doesn't mean that we don't need to do even better. We need better reimbursement. We need broadband in rural areas so that we can explore obstetrical telehealth programs so people don't have to travel for all the services, specialty services in obstetrics. We need many things, but we all should celebrate what we do have.
You said earlier that you have some really great OBGYN who really thrive in a rural setting. Can you explain some of those characteristics that would make an OB really thrive in that rural area?
Well, we do recruit for our rural track. We recruit people who actually want to practice in a rural community. So I think that desire to practice in a rural community is important. And that it's been shown that people who grow up in rural settings, who have rural roots, who actually desire to be in these communities are going to thrive. You obviously need fabulous training. We have a very successful OBGYN residency training program with, you know, I'm trying to calculate the ratio in my head. We have 80 applicants for every one position. And so you get motivated people who want to practice in these communities. Having a desire to help the community, you know, healthy moms, healthy babies make healthy families, and the healthy families in turn make healthy communities. Many of these rural communities with independent hospitals, they're proud of their facilities and they want to deliver the highest care, and physicians want to be part of that.
What does the future hold for these rural hospitals? Do you expect more obstetrical services to close?
I think we are probably going to see some more closures. There's a lot of mergers and acquisitions going on in healthcare. Large networks are being set up. I mentioned earlier the levels of maternal care. We actually want to have a regionalized system for obstetrical care. We want to make sure that we have women at a certain risk level delivering in the facilities where they need to deliver. Childbirth is a time of great joy, and most of the time it goes well. But when it doesn't go well, we need to be able to transfer those patients, and we need to prepare the families for those transfers, and we need to have policies. And some of our neighbor states have better policies about transport, about guidelines of care. We've done it well in trauma. So we have level one trauma centers. No matter where you have your traumatic accident in Wisconsin, you're going to go to a level one trauma center. We need the same kind of system for our moms. We have it for our neonatal care, but we need it for our moms. So both our moms and babies are getting the best care they need at the exact facility they need to be in.
Dr. Hartenbach, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Kate.
Dr. Ellen Hartenbach is Vice Chair of the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of Wisconsin Medical School. She's also a professor there. Coming up, we look at distrust in the federal government and in each other. Stay with us. There's more to come here on the Ideas Network.